May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Nick Norris. I represent Dr. Blackson in his case against Wexford. We are seeking to reverse summary judgment that was granted in his case on race discrimination. The first error we are seeking to have reversed is where the district court found that the defendant's customer's preference, racial preference, could not be attributed to the employer. In this particular case, Wexford informed Dr. Blackston that they would not be hiring him because he was not a minority. He was not because he was white. The district court found that this simply could not be attributed to the employer. I believe that this finding goes not only against this court's precedent, but against United States Supreme Court precedents. The court to the Ellerth and Farragut cases with regard to sex discrimination, where they specifically find that once an employer takes a tangible employment action in furtherance of a discriminatory action, that they are automatically liable for that discriminatory animus, whether it is their animus, their supervisor's animus, and other employees. I believe that is that once an employer takes a tangible employment action in furtherance of a racial discriminatory animus, whoever animus it is, they are taking liability for that animus. Also, with regard to this court's decision in Diaz v. Pan Am World Airways, this is with regard to flight attendants. It's another sex discrimination case where this court it doesn't specifically say it in Diaz, but it seems that the court automatically assumes in Pan Am. Pan Am was saying that it was making its discriminatory animus because of customer preference, and the same as the defendant here or the appellee here. This court essentially, without saying it, assumed that Pan Am had assumed that racial animus by assuming it's what it's supposed to be its customer preference, and then went on to the bona fide occupational qualifier to determine whether they had an affirmative defense, and this court said no, they did not have such an
affirmative. Let me ask you this. Your argument is this is a direct evidence case. They came out and said, we're not hiring you, you know, because you're white. And therefore, now the employer, Wexford, has the burden to establish that they made a decision that regardless of whether he was white or not, these other grounds would have been enough to make their decision. Can they ever get summary judgment in that situation?
No.
So you're saying that anytime it's a direct evidence case, we just may as well throw out the summary judgment.
Correct.
There's no way to ever get it.
Correct. I believe that that's what McDonnell Douglas holds. In those particular cases.
McDonnell Douglas is the circumstantial.
The wrong case.
Right.
You know about Fabella.
Right.
Okay.
McDonnell Douglas deals with circumstantial. It very quickly, I believe, mentions direct evidence. But I believe once you have direct evidence, you're automatically past summary judgment. Now, the defendant, if it raises a legitimate non-discriminatory reason saying we would have made the decision anyway, then you turn over to a mixed motive. Now, it still gets past summary judgment for a jury to determine.
And well, it just creates a question of fact.
Correct.
Because the burden now is on them to come and persuade, which means they have to persuade as a matter of law, and that's almost never going to happen.
Exactly. I think that is essentially what the case is. Once the employer does that, they don't get summary judgment, but it raises an issue at trial as to whether there's a mixed motive or at all.
And let me ask you this. Is it a legitimate non-discriminatory reason to say somebody's not a good fit?
Correct.
That is?
That is.
That's a non-discriminatory reason?
That to say someone is not a good fit, yes. Yeah. That's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, as long as it's not based on race.
Because it's not in our circuit under the Patrick case, and I wondered why you didn't cite it.
Okay,
I know now. Because here's the problem with not a good fit. Isn't that code for discrimination? Hey, buddy, you're not a good fit. Well, that's what people use to justify discrimination for many, many years.
I think what you're talking about in the Pathry case is where they say it's not a legitimate non-discriminatory reason because it's not detailed enough. And
okay.
That's,
and so where is the detail with your client? What did they say?
They had problems, from my understanding.
There were some arguments,
right,
between the former, the two people, I forget who they were, the Blackstone and, yeah, Blackstone.
The woman.
Yes, Dr. Liddell.
Yes, and presumably everybody knew that there may have, that they didn't get along.
Right. There was, I believe Dr. Blackstone's depo is in the record, and he acknowledges that there were arguments with Dr. Liddell on there. Now, and Dr. Liddell, or at least Wexford, is claiming that Dr. Liddell said, yes, it was because of those arguments that I did not want to hire her. Now, I think once Dr. Blackstone has put forth a direct evidence in this particular case, it goes to the jury to determine whether whether her or Wexford's legitimate non-discriminatory reason is true or not, is to whether Dr. Liddell really had a problem with Dr. Blackstone, or whether that problem was based on race, whether those arguments were based, the reason she had a problem with Dr. Blackstone was because of race. And I think that is something for the jury to determine. If they, and I completely agree with you, Judge Haynes, if they had just said, we've got a problem with you, that's not enough. That's not specific
enough.
But see,
enough. I'm looking at his, I'm surprised that I'm having this sort of disagreement with you.
Oh,
I
yeah.
thought I was going to have it with your opponent. But looking at Lundquist's affidavit, if this is specific, then I'd like to see what's vague. That's all I'll say, but that's fine.
Okay, well,
if you want to concede that, I'm not going to further address it. But
I don't believe that was really addressed in the briefs, and that may have been our error on there to say that their legitimate non-discriminatory reason was not specific enough, but that was not specifically addressed in the briefs, and that may have been our error. But I believe that even with that, even if they do have a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and they, it's still up to the jury to decide, to determine who's telling the truth. Here you have Dr. Lundquist, who is an interested party. I think with this court's decision in Bison, when you have an interested party making these statements, it still allows it for a jury decision to be made. If the court were to affirm the district court's opinion here, it would open up a very wide defense for employers. Every time they decide not to hire someone, they can just, you know, they could make something up. Well, we heard something from somebody. And
he's just not a good fit.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, they could come back and say to your other, we got a bad reference from another employer or something like that, but essentially without the specifics. And it opens up a very, very wide defense for employers just simply make stuff up. And that's what Dr. Blackstone is alleging. Also, with regard to the reliance on Price Waterhouse, I believe that was an improper reliance by the district court. I believe that the Civil Rights Act of 1991 should apply in this case and allow a mixed motive for a 1981 case. I know there, at least from my research, that has not been a specific case on this to say that 1981 allows for a mixed motive case. But I believe the court should rely, like the Supreme Court did in CBOC Wes v. Humphreys this last year, where the Supreme Court relied on Title VII to find that a retaliation claim could be found in 1981. And if there's no further questions, I think I will yield my time.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gallenbeck? Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, there we are.
May it please the court. The first point I'd like to address is the fact that the Diaz versus Pan Am, the BFOQ cases that are raised by counsel opposite.
Could you speak a little louder or at least?
Oh, Justice. I'm yeah. sorry. The BFOQ cases that are raised in the brief submitted by appellant have no bearing, as I appreciate them, on the facts of this case. The Continental or the Germdom and the Pan Am cases, in that they involve a fairly specific set of facts, employers with facially discriminatory hiring policies. For example, the requirement that flight attendants, there needs to be a femaleness for flight attendants as a business necessity. So to the extent that they rely on those BFOQ cases. I think they don't have any bearing on this particular matter. The other point is the district court below held, and admittedly the language in the opinion is a little bit confusing, but the district court, in my opinion, held that there was no direct evidence of discrimination and assumed, for the sake of argument, that there was, and proceeded to offer sort of...
I mean, you have a case where somebody's told we can't hire you because of your race, and it's a summary judgment case? I mean, doesn't that seem just a little bit weird to you? How much more direct are we going to get in terms of evidence?
And I, without question, I mean, the opinion itself seems a little weird to me. I would just, the only thing I would respond to that is that the district court itself found that the statements by Wexford's, or purportedly made by Wexford's employees, required a presumption or inference that Wexford or Dr. Lundquist in particular adopted the or acquiesced to the discriminatory
animus. Well, they told
him,
we're not going to hire you because these guys told us not to hire anyone who's white. I mean, isn't that enough? I guess I'm wondering when you're not going to get to a jury in a racial discrimination case if this isn't it.
And well, I don't think I'd – I mean, what we're talking about in terms of Lundquist's statement to Dr. Wexford that supposedly took place weeks prior to Wexford assuming the MDOT contract, I mean, it's a statement of future intent, and the plaintiffs didn't have – there wasn't a single deposition taken in this case. There was no discovery conducted on plaintiff's behalf. So all we have is that single statement. And admittedly, if the court determines that it is direct evidence and that no presumption or inference is needed, as the district court did, then I think that does take us outside of the McDonnell-Douglas paradigm and put us in a post-Price Waterhouse analysis.
So can you get summary judgment in a direct evidence case? And if so, how do you do it?
That's a good question. I think you can, because under, if I'm not mistaken, under the in the post-Price Waterhouse landscape, we have a direct, let's assume we have a direct evidence statement, then the burden shifts to the employer to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have made the same action regardless. Now, in this case, defendants Wexford didn't concede that this was direct evidence, but offered its reasons as to why Dr. Wexford, you know, wasn't a good fit. And to the extent you mentioned,
I'm just not overwhelmed with this good fit thing.
No, I realize that. And to the extent that you referenced the vagueness, I would refer the court to there is record evidence submitted by Dr. Blackston himself that spoke at length about his conflict or whatever bad blood existed between.
Well, how do we know that's not racial? I mean, in other words, if we're trying to come up with this as a matter of law, sure, you ought to win. You have to negate. I mean, what if it turned out he wasn't a licensed doctor? That'd be the sort of reason that you go, wait a minute, we have to have a licensed doctor for this position. And so it doesn't matter all this other stuff. And I'm asking, if you had that kind of evidence, could you win? Or are you always going to have, in a direct evidence case, a jury question, regardless of what other evidence there is?
I don't believe you always have one, and that is in instances where the, let's say the direct evidence is put forward, the court then engages in a post-Price Waterhouse analysis, looks to the preponderance of the evidence, sees on one side that the employer has proffered legitimate non-discriminatory reasons, and looks at a plaintiff's case and says, you have one, you know, a single affidavit, that's it, nothing more. and the court determines, which, as we believe it has in its opinion order, that no reasonable juror could find that improper or illegal animus played a role in the decision. And then, now granted, that's the liability part. Then you move into the equitable remedies. And the reason you could have summary judgment in that kind of direct evidence case is, for example, if the equitable remedy relief wasn't pled properly or wasn't pled at all, or if there was no basis for an equitable remedy. For example, in this case, Garcia versus Houston speaks about injunctive relief, declaratory relief, and attorney's fees. And Garcia, as well as Lee and Goldstein, and I don't have the cites off the top of my head, they're in our briefs, are clear that where, for example, a position has already been filled by the employer and there is evidence of discord between the employee and supervisor, i.e. Blackston and the person who would be the supervisor, that injunctive relief in the form of reinstatement wouldn't be is not what the court does. That being said,
we would have to send this thing back for the equitable remedy, would we not?
And that's
if that's what we do.
Yes, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and you know, strain credibility and say no, of course not. But in instances where the pleadings and the response to the summary judgment papers don't mention at all.
The district judge didn't even reach equitable, or did it?
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. The district court did not reach that, and again, the opinion, the language of the opinion is not crystal clear to me. But in my opinion, the court determined that there was no direct evidence. It did not address the statements attributed to Dr. Lundquist in the context of a circumstantial McDonnell-Douglas framework, because there was no argument offered by Dr. Blackston under the burden-shifting analysis. I guess one of the points is that in response to summary judgment, we have a two-sentence response in the opponent's brief that says, this is clearly direct evidence, therefore summary judgment should be denied. And that was it. There was no argument set forth in terms of any additional relief, nor did the complaint in the prayer for relief or anywhere else articulate what bases the district court would look at to determine what kind of equitable relief they would be entitled
to.
But, I mean,
they asked for it. They asked for it.
Yes.
When you're the movement on summary judgment, you have to defeat the other side's claim.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I dispute that.
In some way.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. True.
And so the failure to mention it, who does that fall on, the movement or the non-movement in summary judgment?
And that begs the question, and I've talked to several people about this, is to how and when a case becomes a mixed motive case. I mean, if the court determines, as the district court did here, that there was no direct evidence and that the statements required a presumption or inference, our position would be that the burden lies with the party opposing summary judgment to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, summary judgment shouldn't be granted in toto because, citing the post-Price Waterhouse, equitable remedies available to them. Now, again,
we
as...
We don't have to get to remedies here.
Pardon?
We don't need to get to remedies here. I mean, we can't get past liability.
You can't... Is that because...
Well, it's because it's a direct evidence case. And the judge made a mistake on the first prong of direct evidence. So we just have to vacate this and send it back.
So, in other words...
This is a favela case, And Bavella is perfectly clear that in a direct evidence case, there's not, now, I must say, I think Judge Haynes suggested a potential situation where you could possibly still have a summary judgment, i.e., he's got to be an MD, for example, and he's not. That wouldn't apply here, but it seems to me you just can't get past Fabella. And so we just say, this is a direct evidence case. Summary judgment was not appropriate, and just start over.
From scratch.
From scratch.
In the, so underneath the direct evidence model in the Price Waterhouse in the landscape as it exists today, that where there's direct evidence or where the court finds that there's direct evidence, there would never be any summary judgment.
Well, that's what it says, providing unrebutted evidence of a legitimate reason for the adverse employment decision is not sufficient to secure summary judgment under the direct evidence calculus. I mean,
I think you might could get there, under, like, as I posited, what if he wasn't a licensed MD? What if he had a felony conviction, something like that? I just don't think you have that here. I think that's the problem. So we don't have to reach the question of whether there might be a way to get summary judgment in a direct evidence case. It was interesting to me that no one discussed that, but it I don't know that we reach it here because I don't think the good fit, even if that is a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and I don't think it is, I don't think good fit's good enough to get you to, well, okay, now there's no way the race played a part.
The record evidence in the case, and I understand the problem with the good the quote unquote good fit argument, but to the extent that Wexford offered its reasons as to why it made the employment decision, then I mean it talked about. The series, or at least, and plaintiff himself testified as to the series of disputes that didn't relate to race. They related primarily to Wexford's or Dr. Blackston's problems with Dr. Liddell.
I've got Lundquist's affidavit, and he says Dr. Liddell didn't like him, which could be the same because we know that MDoc's the one that said don't hire, you know. So that could be the same issue, and then we've got this good fit. We interviewed him, and he's just not a good fit. And there's this allusion to the part-time, full-time, but there's no evidence that he refused to do a full-time job. And so I don't know the fact that you've worked part-time in your life means you're incapable of working full-time. So I don't know. But in any event, I would doubt that this is enough to get you to the exception to Fabella where you can get a summary judgment in direct evidence case, even if we accepted that this is a legitimate reason. You're back to your jury. I mean, I think you're resting on this thing, it's not direct evidence. And I don't even understand that. I respect the judge's ruling, but I don't understand it.
Yeah, as Your Honor knows, I didn't
You brought the hand you're dealt.
Yeah. again, with respect to the direct evidence issue, it's based on the case law that's out there. The only argument that I offer is that it is a statement of future intent, and there is no other evidence submitted by in opposition to the summary judgment motion at all with respect to any of the employment decision-making process. So the presumption or inference is that in the weeks that followed the statement purportedly made by Dr. Blackston that Lundquist or Wexford or whomever during whatever kind of process actually followed through, acquiesced, whatever you want to call it. I haven't been able to find in the context of a government contractor who contracts with the state, and counsel opposite can correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't been able to find a case directly on point where the contract terms vest the hiring authority in the state as opposed to Wexford.
Have the contract in the record?
We do not.
Okay.
We do not.
So we can't really go around making a lot of assumptions about it, can we?
Well, what we do have in the record is Dr. Blackston's testimony as to the contract terms, and he was...
He was told. This same statement you say was never made. You're saying they never said the thing about, we're not going to hire you because you're white. I mean, that's your position, right?
Your Honor, our position is that, no, for purposes of summary judgment, I think if we argue that off the bat, I mean, that ends the inquiry. Yeah, exactly. And so our position, you know, for purposes of summary judgment, I think has been since the outset, and in reviewing Dr. Lundquist's affidavit, Dr. Lundquist's affidavit refers to the decision not to hire Dr. Blackston and the reasons for it. The record evidence also includes the testimony of Dr. Blackston as to his problems with the way that Dr. Liddell handled things. So,
I mean, is that a defense? Can you say, I'm only following orders? Is that a defense to race discrimination
in
2009 in the United States of America?
In this context, I don't know the answer to that question because, as I said, I mean, I looked high and low, and the court or counsel opposite can educate me if there is a case out there that has a government contractor terms control, and we're not, and by we I mean Wexford, the agent for the MDOC. They have invested us with hiring, firing decision, that kind of stuff. So,
I mean, that's even scarier to me that a state can discriminate based on race. Gets even worse.
I don't disagree, but the cause of action in that case, if any, would lie against the state. I'm not aware. I understand the customer preference cases that were cited by counsel opposite the BFOQ. I don't think it's a BFOQ case. I think that the real question is whether this purported mere acquiescence took place supposedly stated by Dr. Lundquist or Dr. Damoff in a conversation, you know, weeks before Wexford assumed the MDOC contract, whether or not that allows the imputation of discriminatory animus to Wexford. And as I said, I looked high and low and didn't find anything that was directly on point as to that issue. The only remaining point, as my time's running out, would be that Wexford's position would be that because assuming the district court found direct evidence, proceed under the Price Waterhouse. That remand for determination with respect to the equitable remedies, as described in Garcia, would be appropriate because they weren't addressed in the memorandum opinion written at the district court level. And
I think we have your argument.
Yep, I believe you do too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Norris.
Very quickly, Your Honor, to address Judge Haynes' scenario with, for instance, if I had applied for this job, I'm not a medical doctor, but it requires a medical degree to get this job. I still believe in that case it gets past summary judgment. If the employer comes, if I were to apply for that job, did not have the minimum qualifications for it, but the employer says, I'm not hiring you for this job because you're white, that shows that they have a motive to not hire me because I'm white. Now, I also may not get the job because I'm not qualified, and that kills all the other damages, but I think you've still got a mixed motive case, and you have declaratory, injunctive, and attorney's fees.
The only other kind of reason that I'm that perhaps could be posited, and it just could be just that, is if in a particular prison you have so many black inmates and there is a culture of distrust of any white guards or anything like that, and it can be proven such, then perhaps it's a BOQ. I don't know. But I'm stretching that point.
Well, I think that can't be the case because...
You may be right.
I think that may be the case if you're dealing with other discriminatory factors. BFOQ allows for sex, religion, those types of BFOQs, yeah. But it
and
does
in fact,
not.
I think then wasn't that raised in California, a similar argument that they wanted to segregate all the different gangs and nationalities or whatever, and they said you can't do it.
Correct.
So
I think that is one that it's just race. You cannot bring a BFOQ to it. So, if there's no other questions,
thank you.